Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 209. I am because we are the family in Africa with Dr. Elaine Leader.
Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast with your host, Dr. Dave. Coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area, Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
Having been a social worker, I like the macro looking, but then I want to know, what does that do to the individual, like you? What does that do to the individual? So I have interviewed people about, well, what do you think about coming from a family that has five mothers? Or what is it like to be a wife with four other wives? So I try to get those examples as well.
That was the voice of my guest, Dr. Elaine Leader. Elaine Leader, MSW, MPH, PhD, is a professor of sociology and the dean of the School of Social Sciences at Sonoma State University in Rohnert Park, California. Previously, she was a professor at Ithaca College, Ithaca, New York. She has 32 years of distinguished accomplishments and experience in academia and public service. Dr. Leader is listed in Who's Who of American Women, Who's Who in America, and Who's Who of American Teachers. Her awards include a National Endowment of the Humanities Fellowship, Outstanding Teaching Awards, Research and Travel Grants, and numerous awards from student and community agencies. Twice she sailed on University of Pittsburgh's Semester at Sea, once serving as the core director to all 700 passengers on board. She has appeared on Road Rules on MTV in conjunction with her voyage on Semester at Sea. Her exemplary career encompasses roles as professor slash teacher, psychotherapist, consultant, author, and advocate for social justice. She received her undergraduate degree from Northeastern University and master's degrees from New York's Wurzweiler School of Social Work at Yeshiva University and the University of California School of Public Health in Berkeley. She completed her doctoral work at Cornell University in 1985. Over the years, she has published four books and more than two dozen articles on sociological and psychological issues. Her third book, The Family in Global Perspective, A Gendered Journey, is being used at dozens of campuses in the U.S. today. She lives in Sebastopol, California, and travels widely. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Elaine Leader, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you.
Well, it's great to finally have a chance to interview you, having known you for a number of years, both as friend and as dean of the School of Social Sciences at Sonoma State University.
I'm looking forward to this. I've wanted to do it for quite a while. So
I know.
Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah. Well, there's so many things that we could talk about. I know you to be passionate about issues of social justice, and also you've been doing work at San Quentin Prison, which I think would make for a very interesting topic. But I'm thinking we'll save that one for the future, since I recently interviewed another guest about prison work. So I thought today we'd focus on your interest in the family in Africa. So how did you become interested in the family in Africa?
Well, it's a long story, but I'll try to make it brief.
Okay.
When I was in graduate school, getting my MSW in New York City in 1960, 67 to 69, there was a wonderful woman there who had come from Zambia to study in my program, and we became good close friends. She came to visit my family in Massachusetts, and I, you know, we visited a lot and were close. And then she went back to Africa for, you know, to continue her life. She was a mother and a social worker, and some 20 years later, around 1989, I got a letter from her saying, I have been looking for you for 22 years. I finally found you. Why don't you come for a visit? Well, you don't get an invitation like that without responding immediately, and I was in a transition in my life and thought this would be a good thing to do. So I flew to Zimbabwe, which is where she was living at the time. She was Shona, had married a man from Zambia, moved to Zambia, and then moved back to Zimbabwe. And so I got on a plane one summer, not knowing what I was getting myself into. And, of course, I had images from National Geographic of tsetse flies and snakes and mud huts and all
right.
the rest of it.
Right.
And men in loincloths,
yeah.
You know, all the stereotypes that Americans have, unless we learn other, about Africa. And so I flew into Harare and was met at the airport with a limousine and taken to a beautiful British colonial home where my friend Esenet and her family lived, and come to find out she was of the elite in Zimbabwe, and her grandfather was the chief Supreme Court Justice of Zimbabwe, and her father was a missionary, and her brother was an economist from England. And I discovered my stereotypes, of course, were wrong. They took me into the countryside. They showed me their lives. They invited me into their family, and they adopted me. And it was the beginning of my love affair with particularly Zimbabwe, but then it grew into larger parts of Africa. So it's a very personal journey, but it led me to want to study the African family. So that's what I've been doing since 1989.
Well, what a fascinating beginning. Now, since this is audio and not video, we should probably add that your own ethnic background is not African.
Oh, good heavens, no. In fact, my father was born in Lithuania and was a Holocaust survivor getting out of Lithuania. My mother's family is from the Ukraine and parts of Hungary. And so, you know, I'm sort of definitely Jewish and white. And I had no idea when I landed in Africa that I would feel the resonance that I did. I remember once going to Jerusalem and sort of expecting that I would feel like I had come home. And I didn't feel it there, but I did have that experience when I got to Africa the first time. And I do have to say my experience is primarily in southern Africa, Zimbabwe, Zambia, Botswana, Kenya, South Africa, a bit of Tanzania. So it's sub-Sahara Africa that I really have been focusing on.
Okay, now I didn't warn you ahead of time, and I don't know if you need to have notes in front of you or not, but I heard a presentation that you gave, and you covered some of the details related to the size of the continent, some of the geographical features. Do you have any of that info at hand?
Oh, I do. Well, first of all, let me say that Africa is four times the size of the United States, and it's the biggest continent after Africa, after Asia.
Wow.
It has 50 independent countries, 700 million people, 1,000 different languages. It's an extremely complex place because of so many cultures, nations, tribal affiliations. So it's extremely hard to generalize about Africa. Each state, for every statement you make, there is an exception to the rule. So that's why when I speak about the continent, you can't. What you might be able to do is you can't even speak about a country, because then you have to talk about, well, which ethnic groups are there and which tribal affiliations, and are they urban or are they rural? So that's why when I speak about it, I try to make more sense by giving examples from different parts of the continent.
Yes. Well, maybe you can talk a little bit about how historical events in Africa have impacted the family structure there.
Well, I'm really glad that you talked about that, because slavery plays a very important role in the history of Africa. And of course, before slavery, there were, and still are, some ancient and wonderful historical organizations. For example, there were caliphates, and there was Great Zimbabwe, and Mali was extremely proud and deeply rooted in its ancient history. There were all kinds of wonderful cultures, but then we get somewhere around the 19th century, or from the early 16th to the mid-19th century, slavery. And the west coast of Africa was particularly impacted by that. There were 10 million slaves who were brought over between the early 16th century and the 19th century in what's been called the Middle Passage. And, of course, the Middle Passage is, you know, people coming across as cattle in on these horrific slave ships, and many of them dying and many of them being thrown overboard and living in unbelievable circumstances that certainly, even though today we have a lot of slavery, they don't get transported in those horrific ways. So there was a high mortality rate because of the mistreatment, and most of them had lack of immunity to the diseases. And so when they came over, they were dying. And slaves were obtained in all kinds of ways, as prisoners of war, those who were born into slavery by their families, kidnapped. Slaves were kidnapped from their home villages and traded in large marketplaces for gold and guns and other European produced goods. And men brought the higher price than women because they could do the heavier labor. And as a result, groups were decimated, tribes were decimated where there was heavy slave trade, but little impact other places. So it was the coastal regions, particularly in Africa, that were impacted, but the rulers didn't let the Westerners get into the interior resistant areas for European encroachment. But then colonialism came along, and as a result, there was lots of conversion going on, trying to take over what was considered pagan religions. And let me say that to this day, there's wonderful ancient religions that are still practiced. They went underground when the Christian missionaries came in, but the white man was trying to bring Western civilization, and with that came Christianity and commerce and allegedly civilization. And the white culture kind of became an informal empire and took it over, particularly in Algeria, the west coast of Africa, South Africa, Nigeria, Senegal, Egypt, and Mozambique. And then by 1880, they really, all of the major powers in those days, Britain, Germany, France, and Belgium, tried to divide up the continent, each into their own area of imperialism, in order to take them over and to run them in the ways that they chose to. So you have to remember that Africa is the cradle of civilization. It's where all of humankind began. DNA now indicates that. And Africa is still very rural. Most of the continent is rural and undeveloped. So when you get to the cities to this day, they're extremely sophisticated, just as sophisticated as those in the West. I remember driving into Harare and thinking I was in a major U.S. metropolitan city. But people are tied very much to the land. That's where their ancestors are buried. That's where people have learned to provide for themselves, and people choose to return to the land when they die because of the connections to the countryside and the ancientness of their traditions. There's animist traditions that go way back as well.
Yes, one of the things you mentioned in passing, the religious heritage there, and I guess there are spiritist religions. Maybe you could just talk a little bit about that.
Sure. I know, let me give you an example. When I was visiting my friend Esenet from Zimbabwe, she took me to the family grave. You know, and when we go to graves here, there are graves in the ground and there are tombstones. Instead, she took me to an rural area where there was a cave. And she stood there and recited to me the ancient history of the Mapundera family and told me all about who lived when and what they did. And there is the belief that those spirits still live with and live within each family member. And so as they honor the family, and they honor their traditions, and they honor their ancestors through the spirits that live on through people today. I visited a very beautiful little village once, and I went out into the rural area and met a man who spoke English. They had been missionary schools, and he spoke English very well. He took me into his home, and there, you know, in one corner were was a little shrine to his ancestors, and the home was, you know, dirt floor, but clean, well-maintained, and the center of the hearth was really related to the ancestors and honoring the and respecting the traditions of their history. And with that, they can bring in Christianity and Protestant religions and, you know, fundamentalist religions. There's no contradiction there. They can live in harmony because one is very, very ancient, and then there's an overlay of the more contemporary.
It's interesting how that happens, isn't it? Now, part of your background is that you're a sociologist as well as your training in social work.
Mm-hmm.
And as you know, I'm a psychologist, so I'm particularly interested in any psychological observations and as well as sociological observations that you have about the family as you've experienced it. I guess one place to start is the family's very central there, isn't it?
Absolutely. In fact, the phrase that I use for my talk in a chapter I wrote in one of the books that I've produced is about African families is, I am because we are. In more of Eurocentric cultures, I am because I am, or I am because I am the person. But in African cultures, and there's more of a sense that the family is at the center of all African life. Families live in really large extended families based on their tribal affiliation. And children are the most precious. They're, as I said, the continuation of the ancient connections, but also for economic assistance. Children go out and get work or help families survive economically. And so one is loyal to one's family over all else, you know, country and the rest come after that. Mm-hmm. Family life is very spiritual as well, in that people, as I say, believe that those ancestors have influence over them. And so they worship the nature and the animals and the ancestors. But there's really a big belief also in healing. And the family does the healing, and, you know, we go to the use of healers, for all kinds of, psychological as well as physical problems. Now let me also say the families don't look the same the way they might look on the surface, what we might expect, like a nuclear family, but everybody is extended back into their non-nuclear and extended families. So, for example, if the family is abroad in other parts of the globe, they still stay very, very connected. If a family member is living in the countryside and there are family members in the city, they go back and forth regularly. In fact, you might remember when Obama went to visit his family in Nigeria, he had to go back to the village, and he found, you know, cousins and aunts and uncles, and there's a huge, just extended family there that you will always be a part of. So it's very central to family life, to the life of any individual, that you see the world through the eyes of your family, not through your own eyes.
Yes, and so what sort of evolution has the family? It still has that centrality, and yet over time, I guess some of those institutions, structures, etc., have been evolving?
Yes, and you know, this, pardon me for using a Western metaphor, but there were two historians, Scott and Tilly, who came up with a typology. They said that they were talking about U.S. History and American families, but they were talking about a family based, a family wage, and then a family consumer economy. And let me describe. Family based is very much where the family lived together, kind of little house on the prairie, where everybody grew things and farmed and produced everything that they needed to produce together. And maybe they traded a bit or bought a bit, but they stayed on the land and took care of themselves. And that's the way we started here, and certainly in Africa that was the way it was as well. But then in the United States, the way we began to evolve with the rise of capitalism and industrialization, we began to develop what is called a family wage economy. And a family wage economy is when some members of the family, usually in Western society, it was the fathers, who would go to work, make money, bring it home to the family, and other family members would work too, particularly as the economy was growing. So that became where the family was, you'd still bring your money home and you'd come home to your family, but you'd go out and you would produce it outside and help the family survive economically by earning money. And then we have moved into a family consumer society in which we, you know, consume together. We go shopping together. We earn money outside or inside of the home, but it is based on consumption, not on production. And so what we've seen in other parts of the globe is sort of an extension of that typology. And again, I don't want to be too broad in my brush strokes, but it's been very helpful for me to understand what's happened in Zimbabwe, for example, with families, in that it started as a family-based economy, but then people had to go to the city to earn some money as economies evolved. But still they sent money back to the families in the countryside, and the people in the country were dependent on the monies that were coming. And you can liken that to many parts of the world right now, developing parts of the world, where people send money from all over the globe to keep their families afloat back home. And there's a lot of that going on. You know, in Zimbabwe, for example, I have my niece who lives on the East Coast of the United States, who sends money back to her father on a monthly basis to keep him alive and well living in Zimbabwe. They're Shona, and a deep dedication to their family and their heritage, and she is really paying for all of his expenses. And then, you know, we're also seeing the family consumerist economy evolve in these other locales across the globe, and sometimes it goes very quickly. You don't have to, you know, you go straight from family-based to family consumer, and we see sort of a quickening of the historical process as this occurs. Now, that's sort of the sociological and the historical description, but let me talk a bit about what happens psychologically, because, of course, this has an impact on the individual. The individual feels very committed to family life back home. So there's always being, you're transporting yourself and your family. Your children go back on a regular basis. Your family comes here and doesn't come like we have, you know, if you're very westernized, where, you know, if my daughter comes from a weekend, I'm grateful that she's been here for a weekend. Families come for months and stay for a long time and work in the gardens and the U.S. To help the family garden or to clean or to cook. So there's really a sense that your family remains your center, even if they're elsewhere and they come and live with you regularly, and you go and are with them regularly for long periods of time. You might talk on the telephone with your family daily. If I talk to my kid twice a year, you know, twice a month, that's a lot. But when you're talking about a family-centered situation, as I have described in African families, they'll call back and forth regularly and know what's happening with the children or the grandchildren or the nephew. Say a nephew is in trouble, a nephew will come to auntie. And Auntie will set that kid straight and get them all organized and back on the right track. So there's really the sense of being deeply embedded in your family life at all times, even though you're an individual.
Yes. So you've described these three typologies, and I guess in Africa, I mean, I suppose all three still exist here.
Absolutely.
But in Africa, I imagine the situation is sort of more dramatic, that that you have more people that are still in sort of stage one and stage two, if you will.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, it's only those who are more affluent and middle class who've moved into the stage three. And do I think that these are, you know, hierarchical? No. They're almost cyclical. You know, there is no hierarchy of which one is better or worse. And in fact, some of us might argue that stage one is still the most ideal. But if you describe what people are living through, it's primarily family-based and family wage. And some of them are not even family-based. I mean, if you start to go into places like Somalia or Chad or the Congo, you know, people are living in refugee camps and they're dealing with horrific refugee problems and civil wars and, you know, genocide. And so there, people just have to rely on themselves, international aid organizations. The whole family has been torn asunder because of these kinds of both droughts, you know, famine, and then man-made misery. And then we don't have any kind of infrastructure in the family to help with that. I mean, if you read about child soldiers, for example, they're torn asunder from their families. They form packs of young men who wander the world looking for a place, you know, get taken into groups of older men who teach them to be child soldiers. So those become the family. So I'm afraid that in some places, the idyllic family based doesn't exist. As I say, Africa is so huge, it's you can't really generalize, and I'm afraid I have been, but there are certainly specifics that happen in different countries that tear apart this kind of typology that I laid out for you.
Yes. Well, within the non-torn apart, let's talk a little bit about, for example, you mentioned aunties. Talk about the role of elders.
Oh, elders are held in such high esteem.
Oh, let's go there then.
Yes, for those of us who are elders. I'll give you an example. Recently, my niece, Sarah, said to me, "Oh, Auntie, you know there's a room in my house for you." And I'm thinking, well, that's wonderful. When I get old, I know where I can go.
Yeah.
I don't have to go to a nursing home. I can go to Sarah's house.
Oh.
What happens is there's the sense that, you know, with age comes wisdom, of course, and also with age comes the connection to the history and the ancestors and the knowledge of the group and the family. And so when you're at a setting, any kind of setting, there's homage paid to the elders. I'll give you an example. When Sarah and her husband and son came to visit me, they wouldn't let me do a thing around my house. Nothing. You know, I didn't have to cook. I didn't have to clean. They did absolutely everything for me because that's the way it's done in their homeland, in their Shona. For example, when Sarah got married, she had to go to her mother's home and sweep the hearth in order to honor her family and that she was marrying into and show respect to the mother-in-law, who is the elder. And and the eldest brother often becomes the third parent. Particularly, I'm talking now about Nigeria, where I've done a little research, particularly on the slave trade. And because of it, what happened is that the Nigerian family really got torn apart because of the slave trade that took over. In fact, in 50 years, almost 500,000 people were sold into slavery. So as a result, families were really torn apart. And the eldest son would, or whoever was left after slavery became the designated parent or the designated heir, and it's continued to this day. And in fact, let me say that we're talking about elders. Elders, for example, the aunt teaches the young people what to do respectfully, teaches about sex, about relationships. The auntie is an extremely important family member, as is, of course, the uncle and the eldest son. So there's a hierarchy in the family. You know, the other thing I wanted to talk to you about is I've been sort of describing something about the families being far away but still being connected. In sociology, we have a term for that. It's called the modified extended family. And it means that, you know, you're not really a nuclear family. You're still an extended family, but it's modified. Modified because you're not living in their homes, but you're still very connected to them. And you could be moving from city to city, you could be moving around anywhere, but you will always show up to honor your family whenever there's an event. You'll fly there for funerals, you'll be there for the birth, you know, you'll be there as connectedly as you possibly can. I heard that my friend Essenet is flying into North Carolina at the end of this month because there is a wedding of her grandchild, so she's coming all the way from Zimbabwe for a small family wedding. So elders, and when she is there, she will be, you know, honored in every possible way by the young people in her family. So elders are at the center of the center.
Fascinating. Now, what about marriage? Does marriage differ at all from the way it's practiced here?
Well, yes. And it depends on the tribe. But let me give some example from the Igbo, because in Nigeria, I sort of took a look at how that's done. People marry through their kinship networks. It really is the joining of two extended families. It's not just a nuclear family or a couple who are marrying out of love. Now, yes, it can be a love marriage, but it's negotiated, particularly by the Igbo. So there's always the sense that you're moving into to form a kinship network through the individuals that you know. And you form, by that I mean you become part of a group. Say you need to get a job, you would go through the kinship network to get a job. If you're going to get married, then you do a negotiation with the kin around the marriage. And so they're negotiated, particularly among the Igbo, and it can take months. There's a middle person. There are soothsayers who determine whether or not this is a good marriage. A dowry can be negotiated to honor the family who raised the bride. And then they're eternally tied together because everyone, including the ancestors, are watching. So there's always the sense that you're bigger, your life is bigger than you as an individual.
Mm-hmm. What about the status of women?
Well, that's an interesting question. As a feminist, I went there expecting, you know, I didn't know what to expect. I knew that my friend Essenet was a very strong woman. She had had 7 children when she came to get her MSW in New York City in the 60s, and she left her kids at home to do this with the family. And I thought, you know, well, maybe they're some real independence. And I would say that there is a very strong sense of independence for women, but there are roles that are expected, and certainly those have all been influenced by, feminism, westernization. So there is a breakdown now of the sort of traditional roles, but they still do exist in some places. You know, the mother and the child are the bedrock of their communities. Polygamy, having many wives, is acceptable in some parts of Africa, Nigeria specifically, as I'm describing it. Among the Yoruba, every wife is given her own room in her or her own dwelling, if her husband can afford it. And he has his own house and he has his own room. And the children sleep with their mothers until they're old enough to go into the boys' rooms or the girls' rooms. among the Igbo, there's also separate houses so that they can minimize the friction between the wives. And this is also in sociological or anthropological terms, they're patrilocal, meaning that they stay at the father's home, and all members of the family live in a compound, and they form a patrilineage, which means that the lineage is traced through the father. So often we have a patriarchy that's patrilocal and patrilineal, and this, again, I'm only talking about certain groups of people, not all of them. Can't generalize in all of Africa. So in terms of women, there are the expectations that they will support the family, go out and work and subsidize. Certainly because of war and because of industrialization and the rise of lots of urbanization, people have been uprooted and sent to the cities, and so women are left back at home taking care of the compound and the farms. So there's power there, but the men go off and they could have other wives while they're off in the city seeking employment. So it's a mixed bag, I would say. In some places you can see, you know, real progress around, and laws, good laws being, you know, written about, you know, can't rape, can't have sexual abuse, women can own property, and then in other parts, depending on where you are, real traditional roles that you're a little surprised when you come upon them in this day and age.
So how many times have you been to Africa?
Oh, well, I started in North Africa and did Morocco, Algeria, Tunisia. That was when I was very young, and mostly I've been focused now in Southern Africa. So let me think, one, two, probably four or five. Different countries, different times, you know, and each time interviewing people on family life. As I say, Zimbabwe is kind of my basis or base because of my connections with the Shona family that I'm involved with. But I've spent time in Kenya as well, studying in South Africa a bit. I certainly, upon my retirement, am hoping to go back and do some more work on this. I wrote a book. It was called The Family and Global Perspective, A Gendered Journey, published by Sage in 2007, I think it was. And in it, I have some chapters on different aspects of what I've talked to you about today, and I would really like to go back and kind of do some more updated research. I am not an anthropologist. Anthropologists really tend to focus on one specific culture and do ethnography in studying those cultures. I'm more of a global sociologist, so that I look at sort of similarities and differences between families in different parts of the globe. So I'll take an example, say, on family violence, and I might look at it in South Africa, Brazil, and the United States. So I do comparative work rather than in-depth ethnographical work.
I see.
But let me also just add, having been a social worker, I like the macro looking, but then I want to know, what does that do to the individual, like you? What does that do to the individual? So I have interviewed people about, well, what do you think about coming from a family that has five mothers? Or what is it like to be a wife with four other wives? So I try to get those examples as well.
Excellent. Now, when you say that this family adopted you, that's not just a metaphor, is it?
Oh, no. It's real. I mean, we didn't have adoption papers, but in every other way, I am a member of the family. Sarah calls me often. I go to graduations. When I was in Africa, I went to all the family functions, and they threw me a huge birthday party when I visited last. There is the real sense that I am integrated, particularly with the folks here in the States, because that's where I am right now and haven't been back to visit in quite a while. But there is email on a regular basis and telephone calls, and I'm a part of this extended family, which I love. I feel embraced and grateful. And, you know, some people laugh when they say, well, don't you mean you adopted an African family? No, I was adopted by an African family. I was the individual. I was invited into this extended family where I was embraced. You know, these are not, it's a very Western view when a Westerner adopts a family. You know, it's like they're underprivileged somehow and we're supposed to take care of them. I need to state loudly and clearly that the family is alive and well in Africa. And although in some countries there's trauma going on, in all other ways they are taking care of themselves, and they are very, we must respect and appreciate and honor the way that they treat and raise their families and take care of each other.
Well, that raises the question of what's been the impact of your contact with Africa and Africans on you personally? How has it changed your own beliefs or outlooks?
That's a lovely question. Well, it's made me more global. Whenever something comes up, I want to know what impact does that have out there in the world. You know, whether it be the economy, you know, I'm not just concerned about the economy going tanking here in the States. For example, what's going on in Zimbabwe right now really distresses me personally. I'm always reading on what's going on with Mugabe and what's going on with the way that the opposition is in conflict there, and the suspension of civil liberties and all the rest. And so I'm very tuned in to Africa, particularly Zimbabwe most specifically, but then the rest of the globe. But also it's impacted me in terms of respect for other. You know, in the West we construct the other, those who are not of the West, and we in some ways marginalize them. We are at the center and they are at the margins. And I'm saying this for primarily, you know, middle class Americans, of which I count myself. So what it's done for me is to put Africa more at the center and not the United States so much at the center. When I wrote my book, I put in a map, or wanted to put in a map, I didn't get to do it. And rather than have the U.S. at the center of the map, I was going to put Africa at the center of the map, because that's where civilization began. So it's changed me in that way. It's changed me in the ways that I relate to my own family. You know, I've tried to embrace them more. I was a rugged individualist, and now I'm much more connected with my own family and really trying to make sure that at all times, even those I don't embrace and love, that somehow or I have trouble with, I still make it a point to spend time with them and know them, because they're my family, and that's because I've been part of an African family.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. Well, what can we sort of generally, we, the Western world, what can we learn from the people in Africa?
Survival, resistance, resilience. It is a continent that has been devastated by so much, by wars, by genocide, by colonization, well, first slavery and then colonization, by being ignored, although that might be good on some levels. You know, the West didn't particularly focus on them after colonization, kind of got left alone for a while. The infrastructure began to fall apart, you know, and then it, of course, got taken over during the independence movements of the 50s, 60s by people who were well-intended, but then became dictators. Mugabe is an example in Zimbabwe, Moy in Kenya, Idi Amin, all of those dictators who, you know, originally we thought there was going to be independence and change, good change, away from colonization, but they became as oppressive as the colonizers. So now I think we're into a new stage, and it's wonderful to see. For example, I have some friends from Rwanda, and they're overcoming what they just went through with their genocide. And there's women in government, and the government has been taken over by progressive peoples who are trying to heal the wounds of the genocide. You know, South Africa had the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. There is a sense of forgiveness that we don't have here. You know, we take an eye for an eye, and we throw people in prison, and we have the death penalty. And there, in some parts of, for example, South Africa and Rwanda, there's an attempt at understanding those who have done us harm. So we need to embrace that, that sense of reconciliation, the resilience of survival. I remember once being in a township, squatter camp, actually, in South Africa. And there was poverty all around me, and there was a child in a black garbage can bag because he had no clothing, eating a raw chicken foot. And I thought, this is appalling. I've never seen anything so terrible. This woman comes out, and she says, "Don't pity us. We are alive and happy." And she was dancing, and there was music, and she was surrounded by her children. And I realized that I was, you know, negatively judging their lifestyles from my ethnocentric viewpoint. So we need to learn to walk in the shoes of the other, to respect and to appreciate the difference, not marginalize the difference.
That's really wonderful. Hey, I'm wondering if you've seen the delightful HBO series, The Ladies' Number One Detective Agency?
Absolutely. Set in Botswana.
Set in Botswana. And it seems to, you know, it kind of shows some of the things that you've been talking about, because you can see both the modernization as well as the transitional stages and some of the traditional features as well.
I love that show and the books by Alexander McCall Smith. It really is a fabulous little series, and the HBO specials on it have really been true to the books and true to Botswana. I've been there, and it's a fabulous country. It's just as the HBO specials indicate, and I urge people to read that. I also urge you to read all kinds of things about Africa. You know, you could read about what's going on in Rwanda right now, or what's going on in South Africa. I would urge people to visit Africa. Pick your country. Everything is wonderful. Namibia is a country that is very democratic and westernized, but also traditional, and it's got lots of beauty to it. You know, go to South Africa and go to Kruger National Park. Go to Zambia and go to the Rainbow Falls and Victoria Falls. It's absolutely magnificent. And the people embrace you. The music is alive in the streets. The food is fabulous. The traditions are embrace you. I'm quite enamored, as you might.
Yeah, you make it sound very inviting. And you know what I love about that HBO series is there's a kind of sweetness. It has a lot of heart in it.
Absolutely. And it, you know, once you get past the cities and out into the rural regions, you will find a sweetness. People will invite you into their homes. Mm. People will tell you about their lives. And there isn't, you know, people say, "Well, are you afraid?" I travel alone. Are you afraid? I am never afraid out there. Never.
Interesting.
Once I leave the city, I have the sense that I am in those HBO specials you're describing, like The Sweetness of Botswana.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, Dr. Elaine Leader, thanks so much for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
It's been a pleasure, David. Thank you for inviting me.
I hope you were as intrigued by Dr. Elaine Leader's remarks as I was. One thing she touched on that sticks with me is the fact that despite poverty, wars, and famine, Africans in general seem to radiate a contagious sort of happiness. I believe this derives from living close to the land, feeling held by long-standing traditions, and the sense of kinship and warm embrace by an extended family, as Dr. Leader described. She talked about how safe she feels traveling in the countryside of West Africa, and she remarked on the friendliness and welcome she experiences on her journeys. Similarly, in many of the films and documentaries I've seen about Africa, I've been struck by the joyful faces. For example, I recently attended a presentation by another one of my Sonoma State colleagues on her recent visit to the Bushmen of the Kalahari. She, too, remarked on the apparent happiness of this materially impoverished but spiritually rich people. The music that comes out of Africa has long been marked by an ebullience that has infected and influenced musicians and musical styles the world round. You'll also recall my earlier interview with Dr. Dan Everett in Shrink Wrap Radio number 194, Life Among the Piraha and Amazonian Psychology with Daniel Everett. Remember how he described these Amazonian Indians as both having nothing, owning no property, and yet living an apparently peaceful and happy existence. The theme is front and center in my mind right now because I've been reading a biography titled Three Cups of Tea about Greg Mortensen, a mountaineer who has gone on to build many schools for the Balti, a tribal group living high in the Himalayan region of Pakistan. They suffer many hardships, but essentially lead a joyful existence. The author of Three Cups of Tea quotes another author who's written about that region extensively, Helena Norberg Hodges, who wrote, quotes, "It may seem absurd to believe that a so-called primitive culture in the Himalayas has anything to teach our industrialized society, but our search for a future that works keeps spiraling back to an ancient connection between ourselves and the earth, an interconnectedness that ancient cultures have never abandoned."
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. And Shrink Wrap Radio is playing on again. Yeah. It's all in your head. It's all in your head. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head.
Well, guess what? I've got a summer cold. Can you hear it in my voice? My nose is plugged up. The problem with a cold is that it sounds so insignificant. But a cold can really knock you out for a while. Back when I was teaching full-time, I noticed a pattern that I would often get sick at the beginning of vacation periods. It's as if my body was holding itself together just long enough to get the work done, and then once it was safe to let down, it would give me an enforced rest. Well, even though I only taught one course this semester, it would seem that old habits die hard. My dreams class is over, and here I am with this cold. In truth, though, I don't think it was the teaching that got me down. I had a market research opportunity crop up last week, but there was tremendous time pressure, so a project that would normally take 2 to 3 weeks needed to get executed in a week, and somehow I pulled it off, but I think it weakened my resistance. Freud, Jung, and Adler are often mentioned in the same breath. But how much do you know about Adler? I really didn't know that much, which is why I was eager to interview an Adlerian expert. Be sure to hear my interview with Becky LaFountain, PhD, on Adlerian psychology and psychotherapy. You'll find it on my other podcast series at wisecounselpodcast.com. And speaking of wise counsel and my cold, I had an interview for Wise Counsel with a major academic scheduled a couple of days ago, but because I was sick, I forgot about it and slept right through the appointed hour. Fortunately, my stood-up guest was very understanding, and we've rescheduled for early next week, at which time I hope to do better. We have one new addition to our Frapper map. Let me welcome into our community Kathleen. in Hamilton, New Jersey, who writes, "Great show. I look forward to every update. Thanks a lot, Kathleen. It's great to hear from you, and I hope you don't catch my cold." If you haven't done so already, please add yourself to our Frapper map. You'll find a link on our site. It's a little tiny link over on the right. Or you can simply go to frappr.com/shrinkwrapradio. And this past week, we've added another one or two or three more people to our Shrink Wrap Radio Yahoo discussion group. And there's some very interesting conversation happening there, and a referral to lots of other interesting podcasts and books and so on. So you are invited to join the conversation, and it's easy to do. There's a banner link on the website over in the right-hand gutter, or you could just send an email to shrinkwrapradio-subscribe@yahoogroups.com. You know, I frequently mention that Shrink Wrap Radio is part of the ProMed Network and also sciencepodcasters.org, and that some episodes can be found on those sites as well. I'm wondering, though, if anyone out there first discovered Shrink Wrap Radio on either of those sites. If you did, would you please drop me a line and let me know? I'm sorry to report that we've not received a single new donation since the last episode. So I do hope that you will help to support this show by making a donation if you haven't already done so. You'll find a big green donate button on the site. And of course, I also appreciate your patronage of our sponsors using the discount links on our site for GoDaddy, PetMeds.com, Brookstone, and Budget Car Rentals.
Hi, this is Andy Hunt of Practical Wellbeing. We're all on the couch with Dr. Dave, so let's snuggle up and, hey, mind those elbows.
Thanks, Andy, and I'll try not to breathe on you all. Okay, let's dip into the email bag. The first one reads, "Hi, Dr. Dave, congrats on reaching episode number 200. Considering the high quality of the content, this is a significant and remarkable achievement." He goes on to say, "I'm not listening in chronological order, and my iTunes machine is tweaked, but I think I have the timing right. 200 is right now, correct?" Well, it was right at the time of your writing, and now it's taken me a long time to get this far in reading the email, so we've progressed past show to number 200. He goes on to say a couple of things. One, after that odd comment from whoever on booming bass, I started listening closely. I actually hear it slightly in my car, which adds a boost on the bass, even when I don't have it turned up. I'm comparing Shrink Wrap to the few other podcasts I listen to and only hear it on your side and not the interviewees. I think someone with a home system, serious speakers, and the bass jacked up could have a problem. Since the norm is earbuds, which probably want more bass, this might just be a feature rather than a bug. Tell who's it to just turn down the bass. Well, to be frank here, I should mention that some time back I added this Aphex VoiceMaster, it's called, and it does boost the bass in my voice. Makes me sound more manly. So that could be what one or two people have reacted to, but doesn't seem to be problematic for most people. Okay, getting back into this email, which, by the way, is from Al. I forgot to say that. His point two, "You've probably decided already, but a podcast every 2 weeks would let me get caught up on earlier episodes and maybe even move into wise counsel. I've heard about 75% of the 200 shows, but only can listen when I have to drive somewhere, and I try to avoid that when I can. As a result, I'm only very slowly filling in the rest. Well, I continue to think about podcasting every other week instead of every week with Shrink Wrap Radio. And I guess it's only my compulsiveness that keeps me doing it, plus the fact that I have four sponsors. And so if I go to every other week, I'll probably have to have two sponsor plugs in each show. But, you know, I really need to give this more serious consideration. And so the next one might be 2 weeks from now. And Al has a third point in his email, And I won't read it, but he suggested that perhaps I would consider advertising a vacation rental property that he has. He would pay me a small fee if anybody rented from him as a result. And so we're going to work that out. He's going to give me a link to the site and so on. But I'm happy to share the information right now. If you're looking for a nice place to rent in Marin County, California, in a very nice coastal area known as Inverness, it's about an hour north of San Francisco, you can check it out at www.searidgegetaways.com. So check that out. Next, we have a voicemail which underscores possible confusion from yet another blog with the name Shrink Wrap. Take a listen.
Hi, I'm just calling. I love your show. It's fantastic. I'm a counselor in Canada. Just to let you know, I don't know if you're aware of it, but there's someone who's created a website that they call Shrink Wrap. So I found it kind of confusing because I looked up at your site, was looking up your site, and I found it instead. It's spelled exactly the same way. But the website is tricitypsychology.com, tricitypsychology.com. And I think they just recently changed their name to that, but you, I don't know if you are interested in that. But it really is confusing because I wanted to find your site and I found it instead. Okay, thanks. Bye.
Well, thanks for bringing this to my attention. I do see that it can cause confusion, and I've sent a request to the person at Tri-City Psychology that they consider changing the name of their blog. As you may know, there's yet another blog with the name Shrink Wrap, which is hosted by three psychiatrists. So the name confusion abounds. I thought I had a totally original idea when I came up with the name Shrink Wrap back in 2005. In fact, this podcast probably would have just been called Shrink Wrap, except that the domain shrinkwrap.com was already taken. So as often happens with a good idea, more than one person may come up with it. The next one comes from a Catholic priest in Michigan who writes, "Dear Dr. David, I would like to post a piece on an interview that you had on March 20th, 2009 with Effie Malley from the Suicide Prevention Resource Center on suicide prevention among LGBT youth on my blog, Early Childhood Psychological Development Growing Up Gay." And he gives a link to his blog. It's quite long, but you could probably find it by searching on Google. He goes on to say, "My interest is about stopping the harm done to children who grow up to be gay, LGBT. I am a Catholic priest who in 1997 learned about psychological harm caused to children as young as 4 and 5 years of age who grew up to be gay in social environments influenced by anti-gay social and or religious norms. I was able to identify personally very vividly with this kind of harm caused that I felt morally obligated to come out publicly to my parishioners as a gay priest." I can only imagine what kind of courage that required. He goes on to say, "I did this to draw the Vatican's attention to global harm that is caused to children who grow up to be gay by their anti-gay teachings, and that it perpetuates this kind of harm generation after generation." And again, there's another link here to an article on his blogspot.com blog site. He goes on to say, "My project slash blog is concentrated on educating the general public on all the factual data of human sexuality, particularly sexual orientation and gender identity, as found in science and religions." Now here's a link to his blog. It's fathermartykurilowitz.blogspot.com. And Kurilowitz is spelled Kurilowicz. He says, "I was so encouraged by your interview with Effie Malley. What a magnificent person she is. The love she has for children is astonishing. She so beautifully mirrored in her interview with you as you pointed the kind of care and sensitivity that is needed in understanding the complexity of this topic. Equally encouraging was your asking your son's permission to tell us after the interview that you have a gay son. Also, it was very wonderful to hear that others have stated what a great relationship your son has with you. Truly a sign of hope. I would canonize you both as patron saints of LGBT children. I apologize. I do not mean to impose my religion on anyone. I was so uplifted by your interview with Effie Malley. Please extend to Effie Malley my deepest appreciation for the work she has and continues to do. If for whatever reason you do not want me to post this material about you, I will remove it immediately. With all best wishes, Barty Gorilowitz. And I'm hoping that I am pronouncing your last name correctly, Marty, but that was kind of the smoothest pronunciation I could come up with. He writes, P.S., with your permission, I've also added a link on the blog to Shrink Wrap Radio. Well, of course, I always love it when people add links to their blogs. And, of course, you have permission to put a link or to repeat Effie's interview in whatever way you wish, as long as you attribute it to Shrink Wrap Radio. And I wanted to make sure that I had Dr. Marty's permission to read this letter, and he assured me that I did have his permission to do that. And it also occurred to me that if there's listener interest in hearing more about this topic, that maybe he would make a good guest. So I'd be interested in hearing from you listeners whether you would be interested in hearing more. Certainly with the news just out, the outrage in Ireland about the child abuse perpetrated by teachers in Catholic schools is very much in the news right now. It might make this topic very timely. I did get a follow-up email from Marty in response to asking whether or not I could read this email and whether or not he might be interested in being a guest. And he wrote, "Hello, David. I would be delighted to be interviewed if it will help to stop the pervasive harm to very young children who grow up to be gay." He says, "My coming out March 26, 1997 was problematic for me at the start, though it was very clear to me what I had to do. It was my understanding that it was clearly what a priest is expected to do. I was and still am solidly at peace about coming out, and that has never changed. My situation became even more problematic as soon as Cardinal Ratzinger became Pope Benedict XVI, April 2005. I'm not allowed to function as a priest, and my bishop, Walter Hurley, even publicly stated in the Grand Rapids Press that he wants me to leave the priesthood, and that I will not do. Because then the Vatican can silence me for good, and once again the Vatican can ignore the harm caused to very young children, as they did in the sexual abuse scandals. The Vatican and its officials worldwide, as it's reported by many of the victims of child sexual abuse by clergy, were humiliated, chastised, and at times even threatened when they came to speak to members of the Roman Catholic hierarchy, cardinals, bishops. However, with the global capabilities of the Internet, the Vatican was unable to continue to silence the child abuse victims anymore. The harm caused to children who grow to be gay are continuously harmed, which is an implicit form of abuse, and as you know, can be more harmful than explicit forms of abuse. I have explained this form of abuse in lectures that it is like society and or religion places a plastic bag over a child's head at a very young age, 2, 3, or 4 years of age, and then telling the child to leave it on that it's good for the child. This harm starts very, very early in life for a child who grows up to be LGBT. Richard Isay, M.D., Jack Drescher, M.D., Sidney H. Phillips, M.D., and many others have identified this kind of abuse caused to the very young who are defenseless. You will not cause me any more trouble when we are about to help. When we are about helping to stop this kind of implicit abuse caused to children who grow up to be gay. It is a matter in good conscience for me that I feel strongly about continuing to do this work. Yes, if you think it would be helpful to read my email on your show, please read it by all means. I made some corrections to what I sent you. I did not have anyone proof it. And most definitely, please forward this email message to Effie Malley, which I did. I cannot tell you how reassuring it was to listen to you and Effie Malley talk so respectfully about LGBT children. Together, you mirrored so beautifully to society how to respect and treat children. And he offers some references, and we'll conclude there. With all best wishes, Marty. Okay, so let me know if you'd like to hear more from Marty. He's really stated his case here in these two emails that I've read. But if you'd like to hear him as a guest, give me a little encouragement, and I will reach out to him. Okay, here's a quick email from longtime listener Paul, who says, "Hi, Dave, hope you're well. I continue..." "I'm not well." "I continue to love your shows," he says. "Have you thought about doing some kind of best of shrink wrap radio segment? I really think people would enjoy and appreciate that. Of course, there would also be no problem finding ample material for that. Regards, Paul." And I wrote Paul, and I said, "Paul, I don't have time to find out and pull out all those little segments for a best-of type show. I mean, that would be a lot of editorial work." I did identify a bunch of my favorite episodes that I was going to do on the 200th review show with my friend Jerry Trumbull, but Jerry thought that would be too boring to do, and so we didn't do it. So if there's a listener out there who wants to create something by pulling out segments from shows that would represent kind of a best-of, that sounds like a wonderful project. Let me know if you want to take it on. The next one reads, "Hello, David. I'm so sorry this one took me so long." Oh, this comes from Amy, who's done some transcription work for me, and she's also a graduate student. So Amy writes, "Hello, David. I'm so sorry this one took me so long." And she's referring to her transcription of episode number 189, which she finished and is now on the site. And she said, "Here's a little update. My graduate school application was due on February 2nd, which contributed to the delay in sending this transcription back to you. Yes, that's application singular. I only applied to one program, which is the California Institute of Integral Studies PsyD program. I want to thank you again for your amazing podcast because it really helped me realize this is what I want to dedicate my life to. You are proving a priceless service. I have my graduate school interview on Monday, 3:30. That's March 30th, so I will be back in your neck of the woods. I live in Los Angeles." And she offers to do more transcriptions, and of course, I am very much open to that. And she signs off. It's Amy. And the next one comes from Brad Jacobson through Facebook. Brad's very active in our new Yahoo discussion group, and you will recall that he's also the young man pictured on the site in episode number 200 wearing the Shrink Wrap Radio t-shirt. And so in Facebook, he writes, "Thanks again for your nice comments on the photo I sent in. I was just listening to episode number 201 and thought I better reply to your comment about my Shrink Wrap Radio t-shirt before I forget again. I'm glad to hear that my wearing it has given you renewed vigor to leave the ads on your site. By the way, I get a lot of comments on the shirt whenever I wear it. And on more than a number of occasions, people have written down the website after asking me about the show. For example, young dude at drive-thru coffee shop who is into personal growth, fellow members of a local tarot group of which I'm a member, various university professors and students. I'm proud to say that I enthusiastically and earnestly promote the show whenever I'm queried about the shirt. Not sure if I mentioned that I'm an American with an Aussie wife. After living over 5 years overseas, I'm keenly aware of just how earnest we Americans can be. Sometimes I have to tune it down a bit. Ha ha ha. After listening to Dr. Judith speak about intuition, I thought I might add that the initial picture I sent you was based on an intuitive impulse. I'm really delighted to hear that it might have saved you from taking the t-shirt option off the website. Considering how much fun I have wearing it, that would be a shame. I hope other listeners will get their own and find out just how often it opens up opportunities to share their passions, psychology, podcast, shrink wrap radio, with those who take notice of it. Brad." So there you have it, folks. Go out and get yourself a Shrink Wrap Radio t-shirt. I don't make any money on it. The information is on the site in the right-hand gutter. And you'll have a lot of fun, and you'll be glad that you did. Okay, one more email. I know this is running long, but I'm trying to catch up on all these back emails. And this one comes from Axel in Germany. "Hello, David. Maybe you remember me. We were in contact about some of your shows because I not only love your work, but also use it in school as I'm a teacher in Germany. I love the idea of doing world work and of making the world a smaller place. In order to work in that field, I thought about asking you for a favor. As you might remember, I'm also a Gestalt therapist, and I'm working on a book about dreams. The concept is to let the reader kind of sit next to me when I'm working with a client. So I thought you might know people who would be interested in working with me on one of their dreams via Skype. The idea is not only to achieve something for their personal growth of the people, but also to connect the old world a little bit closer to the new world. I wouldn't want to have money for the work, but the allowance to write something, that is the permission to write something about the work in my book. Maybe you like my idea too. If so, I would be happy to hear from you. Nonetheless, I wish you all the best from Germany, and that's from Axel. So I'm reading this here in case some of you might be willing to work with Axel to let him work with your dreams via Skype. And maybe you'll end up in his book, and you can ask him to disguise your name. I'm sure he'd be willing to do that. So feel free to contact Axel directly. His email address is axelreisdorf@web.de. And Axel Reisdorf is spelled axelreisdorf@web.de. I was always a dog person, but now we have a cat. Or perhaps I should say, a cat has us. If you have a pet, you know that their medications can cost you a bundle. Now you can automatically save 10% plus get free shipping on orders over $39 by following the Pet Meds link on our page at shrinkwrapradio.com. Okay, so that better wrap it up for today. Send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can leave voicemails on Skype where I'm ShrinkPod. You can use the My Chingo button, which nobody ever does. You can leave voicemail on our phone, which nobody ever does. 206-337-0622. And thanks to my guest, Dr. Elaine Leader, for sharing her experiences and observations on the African family. My next show will very likely feature John Valentino, who was involved in the PEARL, or Princeton Engineering Anomalies Research Laboratory, research referred to by previous guest, Dr. Dean Radin. Now, John Valentino has made some of the underlying technology available to you and me so that we can do our own experiments in synchronicity. I think you'll find it interesting, to say the least. Until next time, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.